This is Philip Kotler, author of Marketing 6.0, The Future is Immersive. And you are listening to the Marketing Book Podcast.
Welcome to the Marketing Book Podcast, helping you keep up with the smartest thinking in the quickly changing field of modern marketing. And now, here's your host, Douglas Burdett.
Hello, thanks for joining me on the Marketing Book Podcast, where every Friday I publish an interview with the author of a new marketing or sales book. This show has been named one of the top marketing podcasts by Forbes and LinkedIn, amongst others, and has millions of downloads and listeners in over 185 countries. Don't worry about taking notes. You can find links to everything linkable in this episode's website page at marketingbookpodcast.com. And since I get to read every book featured on the show, if I can recommend a specific marketing or sales book or any other resource I know of for whatever challenge you're facing, connect and message me on LinkedIn, and I will do my best to get you pointed in the right direction. And to make sure you never miss an episode, you have a few options. The best way is to subscribe to the podcast on your favorite podcast app, like Apple Podcasts, or go to marketingbookpodcast.com and sign up for email notifications. Or if you're on LinkedIn, find the Marketing Book Podcast page and click the subscribe button and maybe meet some of your fellow listeners. All right, let's get on with the show. Today, we welcome back Dr. Philip Kotler to talk about the book he has co-authored with Hermawan Kartajaya and Iwan Setiawan, Marketing 6.0, The Future is Immersive, published by Wiley. Philip Kotler is Professor Emeritus of Marketing at the Kellogg School of Management, Northwestern University, where he held the S.C. Johnson & Son Distinguished Professor of International Marketing. He's one of the world's leading authorities on marketing, widely regarded as the father of modern marketing, author of over 90 books, recipient of numerous awards and honorary degrees from schools around the world, and voted as the number one guru in management in the list of top 30 gurus of management, 2022. The Wall Street Journal ranks him among the top six most influential business thinkers. He holds an MA from the University of Chicago and a PhD from MIT, both in economics. Dr. Kotler has an incredible international presence. His books have been translated into more than 25 languages, and he regularly speaks on the international circuit. And interesting fact, he's 92 years old. Dr. Kotler, congratulations on Marketing 6.0, and welcome back to the Marketing Book Podcast.
Doug, it's always good to be interviewed by you, and I'm looking forward to this talk about the new book that I just came out with, Marketing 6.0.
Well, terrific. I'm honored to be able to talk to you again, and particularly about this. And this is the fifth visit you've made to the Marketing Book Podcast, and I'm grateful for that, and so are the listeners around the world. And only a few other authors out of about 350 on the show have been on as much as you have. But I should say, you are, by an order of magnitude, the most popular guest based on, if nothing else, by the number of downloads your interviews generate. So I thank you for that.
Good. Thank you very much, Doug. And I enjoy you as one of the top broadcasters and always ready to talk about new things with you.
Well, thank you. Now, I did have to ask one question, because I interviewed you a few years ago about your autobiography, and like so many people, I know a lot of trivia about Dr. Kotler. And you were an undergraduate student at DePaul University for 2 years and were then accepted without a bachelor's degree into the master's program at the University of Chicago. Is that correct?
Yes, because I started to want a career as a accountant and lawyer. And DePaul was a very good school for that. But as I thought about things, I wanted to get more basic, and the field of economics always intrigued me because it answered questions that are important. How do we create wealth and how do we share wealth? But I found after a while it doesn't talk very much about how wealth is shared so much as how it is produced. And I also found that the idea that man is a rational man, by the way, they didn't say women, they said in the male form, and it knows full information and makes very intelligent decisions on brands, and you know, that model is so obsolete that I never left economics, but I decided to that I could get more realistic with marketing, because in marketing we treat the whole human being, who's not only intelligent but emotional And all that has to be brought out if we're going to try to understand human behavior and economic behavior.
And they're not rational either.
There's maybe 20% rationality and 80% emotion, not only in the decisions of the consumer, who is driven by habits, but also the CEOs of companies. They are emotional too. If you're going to face a multi-million dollar decision, you're going to be nervous about it. And your mind as a CEO is in an emotional state, worried about the risk and everything else in making the decision.
Yes. So you never got that bachelor's degree. And I'm just curious, when you got to the University of Chicago, did Milton Friedman give you grief about that?
Yes, but it was a wonderful grief because I sat in his class twice because, not that I didn't get an A the first time, but because he's always changing and growing as a thinker, and I wanted to hear him a second time. But, you know, it's the old economics. It's the free market economics. It's one that hates government getting involved in the economy. And I had to redress things by going for my PhD at MIT, where more Keynesian economists, Paul Samuelson and Robert Solow, again, also Nobel Prize winners, were going to correct my misinformation from Milton Friedman.
Milton Friedman wasn't always that way, though. He wasn't always a free marketer, was he?
No, he was a free marketer very much, and he thought that government is the cause of our problems.
I thought earlier on he was more of a, like you said, a Keynesian.
No, he was never a Keynesian. He was anti-Keynesian. Yeah.
Okay, because I do remember that in World War II, not that I was around then, but he helped to invent the payroll withholding tax system that we still enjoy here in the United States.
Well, if we do, yes, that's true. That's just normal work to be done, and he did it. But at the same point, he had a lot of followers. The business community practiced neoliberal economics. And that's where we got the British woman. You remember? I'm trying to recall her name.
Margaret Thatcher?
Margaret Thatcher was very much a Friedmanite, too, about pounding heads together and making as much money, and no social responsibility, by the way. Let the people who get the profits, namely the investors, decide who they want to support. Don't make the company a decision maker in charity.
Yes. And we're going to talk about a couple of your other recent books here, and that some of that may come up as well. Let's jump into the book. Let me ask you a few questions about a few of the chapters. But first, Marketing 6.0 is the fourth book in a series. So before we talk about this one, could you recap for listeners who may not have read them the highlights of the previous three books, Marketing 3.0, 4.0, and 5.0?
Yeah. All right. It all started with 3.0. in which we discuss what 1.0 marketing would be and 2.0 and 3.0. So we never wrote about 1.0 or 2.0, but we designed what it is in the book 3.0. 1.0 would be just old-fashioned marketing, where you create a product and you advertise it and price it and then you sell it. 2.0 got to be a little more interested in some social responsibility. And 3.0 almost went all the way that maybe a few companies are totally devoted to be in the pursuit of not just money, but of creating a better world. So 3.0 had that concept. 2.0 wanted money-making mixed with some social responsibility, and 3.0 wanted companies to be doing the right thing by making the right products that are good for people, and so on and so forth. Now, the next book came out, 4.0. Why? Because we noticed that a new host system was coming into being. It was called the Digital Revolution. And, you know, it's a 0-1 that we could represent text and pictures and images and everything else using the digital system. And it was very important to convey to business readers what is going to be possible, the many wonderful things that will be possible with digital thinking, and that they should actually move their more or less mechanical analog systems into the digital world. And we make the argument. That was for 4.0. In 5.0, we wanted to put out a model of how to conduct the customer journey, how to map customer journeys. What do prospects who haven't bought your brand go? What do they go through? They go through five steps, which we call the five A's. And they finally, if we ever get a prospect into being not only a customer, but a top customer, a customer who loves our company and our brand and is an advocate. And every company should aim to have some customers who love the company and brand so much that they become our marketing people, basically. Mm-hmm. They're even more effective than our salespeople because they're not coming out of being paid to broadcast us.
Right, and they're more effective than anything we might say as a company.
Oh, word of mouth is so much more attended to than anything salespeople often say. So that was 5.0. We wanted a whole model of how we can grow our business. Then 6.0, which is the book that just came out, is there because we believe that besides there being a real world that we all live in day after day, there are other worlds being created, which we use the word a metaverse, and meta means above or more than a metaverse. Now, there's not one metaverse. And let me give you a sense of the metaverse. Many years ago, I joined a thing on the internet called Second Life.
Mm-hmm.
And Second Life involved my getting a costume, because those who joined Second Life as individuals, they had to either be themselves, but they often wanted to sort of get a disguise, and we call it an avatar outfit, and they could be more handsome than they normally might be. They may be, they're in a costume, basically. Mm-hmm. They're not known for who they actually are. And then, as an avatar, you meet other avatars, male and female. You may flirt, you may interact and join projects. In fact, in Second Life, there were some projects going on, some games were being played, sports was of great interest, fashion shows. And it turns out that I even noticed that some people were paying for property or paying using a currency where they could buy a home, because there was someone selling a home,
mm-hmm.
and the home was a design to which they could add furniture, the furniture being bought from some other vendor of furniture. And the whole thing was just an unusual experience of being able to be on another planet, in a sense. In other words, a metaverse is a area where a lot of people are interacting. And they may be watching programs, playing games, they may be running projects, they may be building their life and their home and so on. And they're buying and selling too. Now, this actually is what has happened. Namely that in 6.0, we wanted to talk about two types of metaverses, those that are centralized and those that are decentralized.
Mm-hmm.
And in a sense, a decentralized metaverse is not being operated by any one governing system. It is it's free. People did get together, and they are there are rules, of course, but they're broad rules, and they can interact in all kinds of ways. And whereas a centralized one usually is done because maybe they want to focus basically on game playing or something else. Now notice this, that the internet itself is being used to play games, poker, all kinds of games. And in a sense, we have all metaversed into things even before there are metaverses with avatars, metaverses with currencies. By the way, the currency is usually Bitcoin or one of the other currencies, which is a kind of a phony a currency that is being used. You buy some of that artificial currency and you pay for things you want when you're on the metaverse, and you get the things you want. So this is an intriguing concept. It's so intriguing that Facebook and Mark Zuckerberg, changed the name of his firm from Facebook to Meta, mm-hmm. Basically, believing that that's an unexplored world. So one of the things to remember, there are going to be several different metaverses, and they're not related to each other. They're just creations, in a sense, where some people might find, I like this particular metaverse because they run fashion shows, they run concerts, and so on. Now, what that really means is you're putting on spectacles or glasses, and you're getting an experience. And the central point is that the metaverse is an opportunity to create new experiences that people haven't had.
Yes.
Some of you, of the listeners, know that there were always opportunities increasingly to experience, let's say, Yellowstone National Park. You've never gone there, but you want to know what it's like, so you put on these glasses because there's been prepared an input that will just make yourself feel you're right there walking through the park. Or you may want to walk through the human body, starting with the stomach or whatever else, because one can create a lot of fictions and semi-fictions about places, and that's not unfamiliar. So this whole possibility of immersiveness, you're immersing into new experiences, is what the book is about.
Let's step back for a moment and just clarify a couple definitions. You write that meta marketing is the next stage of omnichannel marketing. And before we talk about all the foundations in terms of multi-channel and omnichannel marketing, yeah, which I think some use synonymously, could you explain what is multi-channel and omnichannel marketing, and why do marketers consider omnichannel a step up from multi-channel?
Okay, so we start with the vision of a small company having only one channel, let's say. It makes a product and sells it through a retailer, okay? Mm-hmm. So the retailer is the only channel of that company, but maybe they find out that this brand also could be put in vending machines, okay? So you could either get the brand by going to a retail supermarket, let's say, or through a vending machine. It may be a candy bar, for example. Mm-hmm. So that's already two channels. Now, maybe they also approach, let's say, where the gas stations, and they notice that gas stations are not only selling gas, but they're also serving ice cream and soft drinks. So that's a third channel. So we get to the word multi-channel easily, that there may be from one to maybe 10 different channels that where your product could be bought. Okay. Now, normally they grow separately, and you appoint someone to manage the gas station channel,
right,
and another the food supermarket channel. Now, but there's no coordination. And if there's no, in other words, each one is being maximized for what it is, but they may each give a different message to the consumer, one message may, one, the retailer may be advertising a special discount on price, but the gas station channel is not talking that way. Mm-hmm. So the movement from multi-channel to omni-channel is a movement toward coordinating the brand work of all those separate channels so they are consistent in the, so any consumer will get a picture of the brand and the same brand picture, whether they're buying their product from channel 1, 2, 3, 4, or 5. Then at that point, we say it's become an omni-channel. Okay?
Right. And I, in the book, it was, I had kind of chuckled to myself, but it's almost like you were writing that suddenly companies were realizing that their customers were actually using more than one channel to make a purchase decision. What a light bulb.
No. It's not. The decision is made in each channel, period. But whether you want to coordinate the imagery about the brand, you want to move to omni-channel.
Right.
And none of those channels are the metaverse yet, right? Mm-hmm. In other words, so we go from one channel to multi-channel thinking to omni-channel thinking to meta-thinking, which is the creation of some new channels which are not in real time.
The meta-marketing.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. That's the cornerstone of Marketing 6.0.
Yeah.
So to give folks a sense of the recipe, there are several building blocks that are organized into what you have in the book is just three layers. And the bottom layer is the technological enablers, and the second is the environment, and the third is the experience. So just to give folks a sense of what's in those three layers, what are some of the key elements in those three things?
Well, yeah, the layers were the introduction, part one. The second was the marketing enabler and environment. And the third is the marketing of experience. It's a 10-chapter book, really. I want to enlarge, however, the thinking. For example, let's say that I want to I'm an automobile company, and I want to create a brand, a new kind of car, even before the Tesla came around. In fact, let's say I created the Tesla, but I haven't sold any. I'm in fact, it's only an idea.
Okay.
Wouldn't it be silly to take the idea and then build a factory to make that car and then find out whether the cars are going to be bought?
Yeah, that sounds like the Ford Edsel approach.
Right, that's right. The Edsel failed because, well, for more than for many reasons. In any case, so it's a smarter thing to design the car on the computer. And, you know, computers are very good. You can make a picture of every aspect from any point of view. But you design the car, but design it really on the computer as a something that does exist. And if a person would put on these special glasses, they can see themselves actually walking over to that car. They see it in its color and form. They open the door. They go in and sit down. They then start the car, and they drive, and they hear the engine going, and they're getting a feel for the car. They see the panel and everything. Now, all of that is a simulation. It doesn't exist. But what you do afterwards is ask everyone who went through that piece of that glass view and experience any interest in that car. Now, the hope is almost everyone who you invited loves it. And they even say, does it exist? I want to buy a car like that.
And you didn't have to build a clay model of it either.
You didn't put a cent in except the money for the cost of modeling it in the computer.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so it's in a metaverse in a rough sense. It's not around. It's not physically there. Okay, so now you can have confidence or you find out you shouldn't make that car, which is fine too. Okay, that's what we're after. We were trying to create what we call immersive experiences for customers. Now, let me give you another example or two. What if a person wants to, he has a home and he's got a living room and he wants to buy a good sofa for the living room. And so he has several sofas in mind, but he doesn't know which one would look best with the other furniture in the room. Well, it's quite possible to put on the computer a picture of the furniture now in the room, and then to place a picture sequentially. First, this sofa that I'm considering, then another sofa that I'm considering. And suddenly, he or she has a view of whether it is a perfect fit for that kind of living room, right?
Mm-hmm.
Is that very different than what's happening in real time now, where a woman sees some expensive clothes and she wonders what she would look like in the clothes? Well, she should actually go into a small room and change and go into the clothes. No, she doesn't have to. They can superimpose any of the clothing she's interested in on top of her body to see. So she can get a picture of you know how this is done. You know that company that makes eyeglasses now?
Oh, Warby Harker?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Apparently.
That's just what I was thinking about, yeah.
Yeah, because how would I look? They have thousands of frames. How would I look? Well, if they had a picture of my face, I can easily see what any pair of glasses will look like on my face.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a broader view. You know, I was talking earlier about avatars and moving around in this kind of new space, but it's happening every day now. People could experience how a product will work for them without much effort, and that's very good because it helps businesses not over-market something that when people actually try it on.
Well, and it also makes buying so much easier, rather than having to have all these sofas delivered to the house to see which one works.
Right. We say that the smart marketer practices frictionlessness.
Yes. Yes. That's terrific.
Yeah.
Well, speaking of buying, let's jump over to chapter 4 about customer experience. And you wrote that there's a growing trend among marketers to redirect their focus from creating and selling products to delivering exceptional customer experience. Sure. And I mean, I think a lot of people hear that, they know that, but that you write that the customer experience with a product from discovery to purchase and usage has become equally important as the product itself. So it's not just a nice to have, but talk about the factors that are driving this real need, which has an economic impact of the customer experience.
Yes. Here's the thing. To the extent that a customer is going to buy something by going to a store, and I'm separating that from just ordering it on the internet, the store is going to be an experience for good or bad, and we should recognize initially that it will come across as a multi-sensory experience, and you've got to manage that carefully. What do I mean by multi-sensory? For example, sight will be very important. They walk into the store. Is it colorful? Is it attractive? Sound will be important. Is it quiet or is there music being played? Can I touch the goods? Touch as a sense is important. Is there any scent going through the store? By a scent, I mean a smell of some kind, a pleasant one, I hope.
Like in a Starbucks or an Apple store.
Yes, of course. So the store, now I used to call this, I invented the term atmospherics many years ago in an article. What's the atmosphere like that the retailer has created for you? For example, if this is a funeral parlor, you better have a very quiet place. A lot of gray color, and no bright things happening. And it's very different if it's a food store, you know, or a department store. So it's a sense. It should tap all five senses if possible, and be very pleasant on all five sense objects.
Right, and one could argue that the successful restaurateurs have understood this for a long time.
Oh yes, that's right. They prepare a fascinating dish with the right colors and this right sense and so on. And so the thing is that atmospheres are designed basically, and now we believe that the creativity that we should expect our marketers to have of having imagination. We want our marketers to have creative imagination, where they know that much experience is routine and not even memorable. So the question is, how do you create memorable experiences? Now, let me give you an example. Let's say I'm going in to buy a fish tackle. I want to do some fishing in Sarasota, but I've never fished before. So I go into a certain place, a certain store, and not only do I see tackles and fish equipment, I can fish there. Right. There's a section of the store that has a pool, and there are fish swimming in the pool. And I could even cast my rod and throw it in. And okay, so that makes the experience more memorable, and that's what we need more of in the future.
Right, and also I think that if I hear one thing, one among many things that companies complain about is the fighting commoditization. Well,
you can't.
I don't think your product can stay very differentiated for very long, and it probably won't have a very long life cycle. But if it's a great experience, particularly immersive, as you talk about in this book, it just seems like a great wake up call. Because I think on the show I've had, gosh, at least a dozen books about the importance of the customer experience, and even just selling different from your competition creates often a better customer experience. So more and more companies are waking up to that, but this was a great affirmation.
You know, I used to work on this question. How do you differentiate a commodity when it's very basic? Mm-hmm. Can you differentiate chicken? Can you differentiate bricks?
Or concrete blocks, yeah.
Or concrete blocks. And the fact is, yes, you can. And in different ways.
Yeah.
For example, with the concrete kind of thing, is why is it that in Mexico that the leading concrete firm has all the business basically? Well, they have trucks moving around ready to pour concrete at the time needed. They can reach a destination in 20 minutes because there's enough trucks moving around to pour concrete within 20 minutes. So it isn't the concrete, is it?
No.
It is the It's the delivery system is better. And chicken, look at what Purdue did with chicken as a brand. I mean, first of all, we know that Mr. Purdue looked like a chicken, first of all.
It was featured in his advertising.
He cackled like a chicken.
Right.
He just loved chicken and chickens as family members, so that you know he takes care of them. And you better
nowadays, that would
brand.
Be called very authentic.
Right. Yeah, he was trying to be authentic in mm-hmm. his love of the product. So you're right. We're in a world of increasing commoditization, but differentiation is always possible. In fact, anyone who says, and we have to go back to Ted Levitt would say, you're just not thinking if you think that, there's nothing that could be differentiated because it's a commodity.
Mm. Yes, he gets mentioned a fair number of times on the podcast, and he's mentioned in so many books, particularly the article he wrote for the Harvard Business Review about marketing myopia.
Oh, that's his most memorable piece, but all of his articles were terrific. But myopia is the idea that you're so close to what you're making, you don't realize it has so many other possibilities.
Yes.
Yeah.
Like the railroads thought they were in the railroad business when they didn't realize they were in the business of getting stuff from point A to point B.
Exactly. Exactly. They should have been in the airplane business when airplanes started to take
off. Air cargo, shipping, trucking. Yep. Yep.
Yeah.
I see that all the time. So one thing I want to mention is that, and you've mentioned this a couple times in the book, that e-commerce only accounted for less than 15% of total resale sales in the U.S. in 22. Do you find that most people think it's higher than that?
Yeah, I think there's an impression that it's higher. You know, during the COVID period, most of us couldn't go out and shop. So naturally, we thought that most of what we got was from online. And maybe it was higher than 15% online as a percentage of total sales.
For a while.
For a while.
Yeah.
But here's the thing. People are going back to, into stores now. But, you know, COVID is coming back. We hope it doesn't get to be the way it was before, which was an awful loss of two or three good years for people and deaths and so on.
Yeah.
But the main thing is that I think it will eventually get to be 50-50%. I think any store that says, no, we're only going to – any company that says we're only going to sell through stores and doesn't do a good job of orders coming on the internet – with returns is going to make a mistake. People expect good return possibilities as well.
Mm-hmm. Well, for all those, I mean, the book to me made the point that you cannot abandon the retail approach. People like that, and you can do so much more with it. And you even go into a fair amount of detail about how companies, smart companies, are and will create immersive environments in the real world rather than just in the virtual realms. And I found it interesting that you use IRL versus URL. I had never seen that that continuum in real life versus the uniform resource locator.
Here's the thing that impresses me. Companies generally that are successful are going to stay doing what they're doing. And maybe say to us, the metaverse is of interest, but I'm not going to make the investment. I mean, first of all, they may say, my customers aren't even up to that. They haven't even heard of the metaverse. So why should I make any investment and so on? Secondly, my competitors are not offering metaverse dimensions to their offerings. So I'm going to just stay where I am. Now, that's understandable. That's understandable because there's plenty of ways to improve your company's performance without becoming a metaverse extender too.
Mm-hmm.
But they better be careful even there that they're missing out on a big opportunity frontier to demonstrate new types of experiences, immersive experiences. And maybe they're exaggerating the cost of preparing to offer those kinds of things. So I'm not asking a company to actually open a separate metaverse, which would be, you know, the one where I have to get an avatar and meet a lot of people and they have to advertise that it's either decentralized or centralized metaphor and that it has land for sale.
Mm-hmm.
No. But be aware that if you especially are interested in the younger generation, and that, I'm talking about Generation Z and Alpha,
mm-hmm.
those kids grew up with games galore and the internet galore, and they are ready for this. And if your company is trying to win by catering in part to the youngest generation too, you should start entertaining them with the metaverse. They're ready for it.
So if listeners can understand, there's a lot of description of the different ways that you can make your retail experience more immersive. You talk about seamless transactions, contextual recommendations, interactive engagements, augmented discoveries, and pre and post experiences. And as I read through those in the book, I'm thinking I've already seen most all of that in probably the earlier forms at a lot of retailers.
Very good. Yeah, we had that description of those possibilities. And what truly says that maybe companies are doing a little more of immersive work than they even recognize themselves.
Yes. It's like, I don't know if you remember, back in the day, there was a Palmolive dish soap commercial with Madge. And she would be at the nail salon, and she would have her customers with their fingers soaking, and she would describe it, and she'd say, "Well, you're soaking in it. It's already there."
Right.
Sort of a tortured description, but I think the tagline was, "You're soaking in it," and they don't even realize it. So
yeah.
Well, there's, I guess, still a little bit of a disconnect between why people participate in the metaverse and how brands are currently participating. Are there some big differences between people, why they're using it and what the brands are doing?
Well, all right. There are some big brands that have already committed to metaverse work. For example, there's a thing called Walmart Land, Nike Land, Wendy Land. Now, I'm not sure Land, I'm trying to remember if it was actually Land, but there are places you could go now where Coca-Cola created a island.
Yes.
On the metaverse.
Great description in the book about all the things that Coca-Cola is doing. Coca-Cola!
Right. And and you know what it might be? I mean, I haven't traveled to Coca-Cola Land, but I hear that they might have a fashion show for young people, probably, on clothes that they could wear and while drinking their Coke or something, and maybe games they could play. So here's the thing: so a big company like Nike Land, Nike, which is so much into great sports material and activity. I don't have the numbers of how many people have visited Nike Land. But that would be worth finding out, because if the numbers are few, Nike will probably close it down, because there's some expense in managing, you know, Nike Land as a metaverse. But we do know that some leading companies have bought real estate in a metaverse. They actually, you know, even if the metaverse that was created has the new type, what we call cryptocurrency, it can be turned into a ratio of the real currency. So you go on Nike Land to buy something. Let's say you see a very attractive outfit or a pair of shoes, and you want to buy those shoes. And you're an avatar. You want to buy those shoes, and that may really mean that you've seen them. So that's going to be mailed to you, and you either pay in cryptocurrency that has an equivalent value in actual dollars, which is real currency, and so on. But the point is that I remember hearing about one person who has created a whole shoe store with shoes never seen before, and that the visitors to that metaverse who have an opportunity to buy any of these newly conceived shoes with their colors and sizes and so on that would actually be shipped to them.
And this is such a great opportunity for the shoe manufacturers to, like you said earlier,
to test
it out. See what the reaction is. You know, it reminds me of a fast food place I went to a few years back with my son when he was younger, back before he got his driver's license and dad was no longer cool. But there was a Coke machine in the place, and it had all these different buttons where you could mix the different flavors And they were all Coke products. Mm-hmm. And you could test out like vanilla Coke or vanilla Coke with a certain other flavor. And I just thought that was brilliant because Coke is able to capture all that data and say, wait, did anybody realize how popular this particular flavor is? Oh.
Yeah. That's a new brand. Another brand. And, you know, I always said Coke reaches everyone. And wouldn't it be good if they could have a health aspect to something added to a Coke that also is good for health? Because what you're really getting is just sugar and water.
Mm, mm-hmm.
But it would be a secret delivery system for health.
Just sneak it in there. Don't let them know. Well, Dr. Kotler, if readers took only one thing away from the book, just one thing, what would you hope it would be?
I think the basic thing to understand is we're in a world of commoditization,
mm-hmm.
and therefore your product is not much different than your competitors' products, and you've got to always figure out differentiation. And you're going to get at differentiation by making a heavy investment in some of your people being innovative and imaginative and coming up with new ways to differentiate what you offer from the competitors. And it's going to take the form of creating new experiences not normally available when you buy X or Y or Z. So that's the message of the book. If you're right now a business that is not gaining and maybe even losing out to other competitors, certainly always watch what the gaining competitors are doing. And maybe you'll find that some of the gaining ones are moving into the digital world faster and with people who have more imagination and so on. Now, this gives me a chance to mention another book I wrote recently called Entrepreneurial Marketing.
Which was featured on the Marketing Book Podcast. Thank you very much.
Yes, of course. I remember.
And I'll include a link to that interview at this episode's website page at marketingbookpodcast.com.
Yeah, and that makes the point very much that you not only have to have good marketing people who do their jobs well, but some of them should be especially entrepreneurial and noticing new opportunities. You know, it's one's life is very busy just doing the normal things as a marketer, and you haven't got time to imagine brand new businesses you could move into and so on. But you should have a few people who have the time to imagine other things you can do. Just watch Google. You remember how Google always offered its people 20% of their time could be done on what their people want to work on, mm-hmm. as opposed to what they're told to work on.
I seem to recall 3M had a program like that as well for innovation.
Oh, yeah. That certainly explains the fact they have invented so many things. Mm-hmm. That's what their business is about.
Yeah. Well, back to what you said about the experience, I can't resist. I just want to strengthen that even further with two quotes from page 60, where, as I touched on earlier, there is a growing trend among marketers to redirect their focus from creating and selling products to delivering exceptional customer experience. And on the same page, the customer experience with a product from discovery to purchase and usage has become equally important as the product itself. So is there one thing a listener could do today to get them sort of thinking in the right direction about your book, perhaps while they're waiting for the book to arrive?
Yes. I think they should sit down and figure out what their strategy really has been, of which they're probably not fully conscious of. Of course, mm-hmm. there was a document they released. This is our strategy. They tell their CEO and so on.
And it's probably in a dusty binder on the shelf.
Right, and obsolete by now. Right. But they might also ask for pictures of the chief competitors' strategies and notice who's winning and who's losing,
mm-hmm.
and why. And if they are asked the question by any of their customers, are you doing anything different and exciting that I should know about? They should have answers to that, because normally they don't have anything exciting to talk about. because, but you know, these younger people are caught up in a world where games and competition, you know, they're watching TikTok and so on, and they're getting very, very mature at an early age. In fact, many of them want to become innovators. They're going to go to business. When they get to business school, they want to major in innovation or something. So that's a good sign, by the way, if in fact more of the younger generation is entrepreneurial too. Mm-hmm. So the company, they will be attracted to companies. Look, one of the problems is how do we attract real talent to our company? By showing that we value creative thinking in our company. And if they can do it authentically, they'll be prime prospects for those young people to join those companies.
Yes, and if they're inauthentic, they'll see them coming from a country mile.
Yeah, you can't stop bad news from flowing.
Right. Well, are there any recent or upcoming books that you recommend or are looking forward to reading?
Yes, the book I'm working with V. Kumar, who's now in Canada, and he's just one of the brilliant new marketers around. Many, many scholarly articles, but we've worked on this book called Transformative Marketing that will come out. It's all drafted now. It will come out in the late 2024. Mm-hmm. We have 8 chapters on 8 new technologies. And the first one is artificial intelligence, a whole chapter on how that's going to change business. Mm-hmm. Second chapter sounds like the same. No, but it's generative AI, mm-hmm. namely the new ChatGPT. That's where the real revolution is going to come from. And we wanted a whole chapter on using that. The third is what we call machine learning, because a lot of people who work with data, they want to learn what the data offers as insights into customer behavior. And you do it by basically machine learning. The machine goes and reviews all the data and comes up with some findings that hopefully are insightful. And the fourth is familiarity with IoT, the world of internet and technology, the spectrum of sensing objects, you know, just like our thermostat in a home keeps the room hot or cool.
And collecting data, and yeah, you touched on that in the book.
Mm-hmm. You're walking to your home, and you can click on something right before you get there, and the door will be openable, or your car door will open. So the IoT world and what's happening there. Then the next part is to talk about drones and where they're going to make a difference in delivery, particularly. You know, you've heard that Amazon is thinking of dropping some products off mm-hmm. with drones. And then there's the whole robotic world of what can robots do in the home, in the store. We have a whole chapter on that. And so we cover basically 8 developments thoroughly with lots of data on what actual companies have done with each of these developments. And I'm excited about the book called Transformative Marketing.
Oh, that's terrific. Well, I know a guy that hosts a podcast about marketing books, and that might be a good podcast to come on to talk about the book. So I'm kidding. The door is always open to you, Dr. Fowler.
I know who you're thinking of.
Yeah. He's not the sharpest knife in the drawer, but his guests are phenomenal. So, you know, there's a book that's going to be on the show pretty soon by Dr. Eric Siegel. And it's called the AI Playbook, and he delves into some of these things. And it was interesting because he explains there's a lot of confusion out there. There's a lot of hype. And I think that the book you're working on hopefully will address some of that and make people not quite so frightened, help them realize there's great opportunities, and help them use the correct words.
Well, more of our life will be guided by what we call algorithms.
Yeah.
And an algorithm is right out of AI, but it's really a set of rules that are better because they were learned through machine learning, that do a better job of deciding whether helping a bank decide, should we make a loan to that customer or a college? Should we admit that applicant for our college? So much more decision-making will be done. Normally, it was done by experienced people who learned but didn't necessarily have an explicit model. But we could trust their sense. But now we can take in their inexplicit model, study it, and make it even better into an algorithm that then – and we don't need them to make the decision anymore. Now, that has some scary prospects. In other words, you didn't let me go to your college because you didn't even decide on me. You left it to an algorithm. Well, the college says, yes, but we've tested that algorithm, and it's really bringing to us primarily the best students for us. Mm-hmm. Well, there are biases in algorithms, too, that Definitely. We have to worry about. But the world is moving very much to that. Now, do we move to a world eventually where there aren't – all jobs are run by machine, by robots, by algorithms? What do we do? So right now I'm going to be thinking of very much what a world would look like which has no work. Kind of scary.
Yeah. Well, another book idea. But speaking of other book ideas, you have two other recent books. I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit about those. One of them was from 2021, My Life as a Humanist, and the other is Regeneration, the Future of Community in a Permacrisis World from 2023.
Yes. The one about My Life as a Humanist, you know, humanism is the philosophy of trying to conduct yourself and hoping others do too, to make life better for more people. A better world, basically. Not just for yourself, not just for your family, or just for your nation, but believing that well-being and happiness are two of the most well worthwhile goals in life, and you want to contribute to that. So I have several chapters, and since capitalism affects well-being and happiness, good or bad in certain ways, and I have a whole chapter on how capitalism could even work better than it has been working.
Which you've written quite a bit about.
Yeah, I wrote a whole book on the problems. It's not to find something to replace capitalism. It's how to build a better capitalism, one closer to the Nordic capitalism in Sweden and Denmark and so on, where there's no poor people, basically. Why should a nation ever have – why should a rich nation ever have poor people? But then I had another book on democracy and how do we get better government to do the right things and not to be right now locked into – such terrible opposition that they don't even – the two sides don't even talk to each other. Mm-hmm. So, but the thing is, the book on my life as a humanist has about 8 or 10 chapters, and they take systems and the effect of these systems. And the other book is called Regeneration, and it came out of work we wanted to do to help small towns and cities that are losing population. Mm-hmm. You can, even in the United States, you can drive past many places where they're small towns. They had a good working culture. They had a good company that was running in that town. And now that company left that town, and there's not much going on, and it's a dying suburb. It's a dying town. What can we do? How do we regenerate places to be alive again? What is it? How do you get the right people to work together? And that would be the bankers, the industrialists, the educators, to rebuild their community. And we focused on what's going on in Palermo, Sicily, which is a wonderful city that has great treasures but could be dying, and we want to show all the approaches that are available to regenerate and save places and bring them back to life.
Well, I appreciate you working on what seem to be such intractable problems, and it's great to know someone is doing that.
Well, I haven't mentioned even my new book that we're working on called The Wicked Seven. And the Wicked Seven.
Oh, right. Yeah. I think we've. Talk about that.
No, well, I won't. I'll just say that hate is one of the wicked seven. How do we replace hate with love in a world? How do we get rid of corruption and power drives so the world works more fairly with people? And how do we save the planet? How do we feed the world? And so on and so forth. So we have lots of diagrams in that book, because what we're finding out that the one wicked problem seems to affect the other six wicked problems. And that many solutions are so partial that they don't work. They do not consider the full factors that are operating to make that problem what it is. And that's our hope with the Wicked Seven, that we come with solutions and systems for making things work better.
Yes, and I'll include a link to that site, which is wicked7.org.
Thank you. And
there's a great explanation of all that's on there. I think we've touched on that in the past.
And people need to understand that I work with others on many of these books. I've written many books myself, but others too involve bringing talent together to work on something, and that's, for example, 6.0. I work with the two people who you mentioned, and they've been wonderful. We learn from each other, and the book gets better as a result.
Right, and you've written with them in the past, so
yeah,
it's like getting the band back together.
Yeah, right. I wonder what 7.0 is going to look like.
I can't wait. But please, slow down, will you?
I'll let you know. I'll let you know when that happens, okay?
Well, thank you. I posted a picture of this book on LinkedIn this week to let listeners know what books are coming. And there was an overwhelming response from the listeners. And a couple folks said, hey, I just bought Marketing 5.0. Now you're telling me there's Marketing 6.0, and I said, hey, you picked a quickly changing line of work, so keep up. It's a real challenge, so don't stop.
Okay, good.
Well, at this episode's website page at marketingbookpodcast.com, we'll include links to everything linkable, including all the books that have been mentioned, the sites that we've talked about, and so forth. The book is Marketing 6.0, The Future is Immersive. The authors are Philip Kotler, Hermawan Kartajaya, and Iwan Setiawan. Dr. Kotler, thank you very much for joining us again on the Marketing Book Podcast.
Well, Douglas, it's always a pleasure to hear myself and you, because we're thinking all along, and new things come up, and I always look forward to any interview with you.
Thank you very much.
Take care.